Hi, everybody. Today is Monday, May 12th, 2025, and our friend Colonel Jacques Beau is back with us. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for inviting me again. Hello to everybody.
Colonel, let's talk about what's going on in Ukraine. And do you find the situation that they're in, that they have decided to talk with Russia in Istanbul? Are we heading towards some sort of solution? Is that going to be all about the United States pushing for this sort of discussion, or Russia is changing its strategy?
No, I think Russia has exactly the same strategy it always had. They said, we don't want ceasefires, especially ceasefires that are hanging in the air. You know, they wanted to have, and that's what Vladimir Putin said on the 14th of June last year to the officials of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He said, if the Ukrainians decide or accept to talk to us and have open negotiations, we'll cease fire. That's not a problem. So this is not a matter of stopping fire. But what they said, what Putin said at that time, is that there will be no ceasefire without negotiation. So they don't want to be in a situation that you had, for instance, in the Minsk agreement that the Ukrainians signed with Germany and France as guarantors. And in fact, the Minsk agreement was asking for negotiation between Kiev and the two republics. So the Ukrainians signed, but they never started the negotiations. And that's why the whole process took so long and eventually was, in fact, abandoned by the Ukrainians as soon as they got the military capabilities and capacities to attack the Donbas. And that's exactly what happened in February 2022. So Putin said, well, that happened once, that will not happen twice. In fact, it almost happened in April 2022 because as you remember, we had this second negotiation round. In fact, there was a first one right the day after the start of the military operation. And this first round of negotiation happened at the Belarus border at the initiative of Zelensky, by the way. He asked for a negotiation. European Union came and said stop. So they stopped. And Zelensky came back mid-March to ask for new negotiations, and you had the second round that happened in Istanbul. And early end of March, as negotiations were going on the right track, France and Germany asked Russia to withdraw their troops from Kiev, the Kiev area, as a sign of goodwill. And since everything was going smoothly in Istanbul, the Russians accepted. They said, okay, fair enough. The negotiations are going well. Let's, and they had their retired their troops from Kiev. And as soon as they had done that, the Europeans came back, and not just Boris Johnson was obviously the one that came in more prominently, but the European Union came and said, well, we stopped the process. At that point, the Ukrainian delegation had already signed the agreement, but they asked Zelensky to withdraw Ukraine from the talks, and therefore Ukraine stopped. So what they wanted to achieve was simply the withdrawal of all the Russian forces from the Kiev area. That's all. So these experience show that the Western part, I mean, the Western party, like obviously Ukraine and the Europeans, use the negotiation process for military purposes and not for the sake of peace. And that's what the Russians don't accept anymore. And for that reason, when this was this idea of a 30 days ceasefire without condition. They refused that plainly. So what Putin proposed yesterday, I mean Sunday on the 11th, he made a proposal that in fact goes in the direction of what they want. They want to have a negotiation. And Russia has always declared itself ready for negotiation. The thing is that they want to have honest negotiation. And they don't want to have the Europeans and all these guys. And by the way, I think the Americans understood that to some extent, because on several occasions they said they would prepare the ground for bilateral talks between Ukraine and Russia. So the Americans, what we have seen in the last couple of months was in fact to prepare a situation in which Ukrainians and Russians would sit together and decide. Now, what that was interpreted by some as a negotiation between US and Russia just in the back of the Ukrainians. That has never been the case. The Americans tried to prepare the context, if you want. That means first to have channel of communications with Russia, meaning reestablishment of the normal diplomatic relations, including the running the embassies in both countries, and things like that. So that was the biggest part of the actual negotiations between US and Russia. Now, and then all the discussions between Witkoff and Putin was about understanding the position of Russia, because obviously they noticed that there was a huge discrepancy between what Keith Kellogg was proposing for the discussion and what the Russians wanted. So the whole thing for the Americans was to identify up to which point the Russians were ready to discuss, what was absolutely no goes, and what could be negotiated. So that's a little bit the idea. But they never negotiated, as a matter of fact, the US didn't negotiate with Russians. So now we are in a situation where everybody knows what each party wants, and therefore that's probably the reason why Putin made this proposal. And that, I think, was a very wise answer to the ultimatum that that the Europeans made. It's very interesting that in the media, especially in Europe, there were some expressions they used that the ultimatum proposed by the Europeans. You don't propose an ultimatum. An ultimatum is precisely exactly what it means in Latin. This is the last point. Ultima means last. So there is no discussion after that. So when you say ultimatum, that's the last thing we'll say, and then we start. And for the Europeans, it was to launch massive sanctions and all that. So it was not a proposal, or it's a proposal like in the movie The Godfather, where you have Marlon Brando saying he will make a proposal you can't refuse. So this is a mafia-like proposal, but this is an ultimatum in diplomatic terms. So basically, the Europeans, with an ultimatum, entered a dead end with the discussion, because there was no discussion possible. So Putin, and probably that's why we say he's a very good strategist, because he bypassed the ultimatum and said, well, what I propose is a negotiation, a peace negotiation. And that allows to bypass completely the ultimatum and go into something where you have the possibility of an exit strategy. So that's, I think, is okay. Now, I haven't seen exactly what is the Ukrainian slash European position. Apparently, the U.S. government, I mean, Trump, urged the Ukrainians to accept Putin's proposal and to engage into negotiations in Istanbul. To be honest, I haven't got the time this morning to check exactly what was the Ukrainian response to that. I hope they will take the opportunity to have a negotiation, and hopefully this will lead to a real negotiation. But interestingly enough, now the Russians will say we will not negotiate under the pressure of a ceasefire. We fight. If things are going well, we may suspend military activities. But for now, we are fighting. You tricked us before, and now we continue on that path. We have the negotiation parallel to the military operations. And that's the way. So that's also an incentive for Ukraine not to play with time, as they did with the Minsk agreement, where the Minsk agreement, I remind you, was signed in February 2015, and it never moved ahead. So the idea by proceeding with military operation is to force the Ukrainians to have a real discussions and to achieve a result, not just talking, but having a result. So I think it was a wise answer from Vladimir Putin in that sense.
Emmanuel Macron, Stormer, and Merz, they're trying to somehow manipulate the situation in Ukraine. But the manipulation they're trying to do is somehow in favor of Europe, is somehow in favor of the continuation of the conflict, or they're just trying to make themselves relevant to what's going on between the United States and Russia.
Well, that's the interesting thing. You said it may serve Europe. No, it doesn't. And that's the interesting point. They want to continue the fighting. They want to Ukraine to continue fighting, but it's not for the benefit of Europe. As a matter of fact, they want to continue with sanctions. There will be hardly any, I don't see a resumption of the dialogue between Russia and Europe, even if Ukrainians achieve some result in Istanbul, to be honest, at least not in the short term. Probably in the long term that will happen. And I think Vladimir Putin acknowledged recently that in the long run, there will be a resumption of dialogue, and all that will be, at one point, will be forgotten. But in the short, probably midterm, we'll probably continue to have this split as long as we have people like Ursula von der Leyen, Kaya Kallas, and all that. And as long as we have this kind of spirit in the European Union, which is, as I already mentioned in your show, that we have this European policy which is strongly influenced by the Baltic states and Poland and all that. As long as we have that, there is no much hope to have a honest resumption of dialogue with Russia, because these countries are so adverse to Russia that any dialogue is barely possible. As it comes to Keir Starmer, I mean, UK and France, the problem is that now they have this kind of aggressive stance as an alternative for having no policy towards Russia. That's the problem. They don't have any policy. And we see that on the diplomatic stage, they are absolutely absent. I mean, they are irrelevant, completely irrelevant. On the Macron side, we can imagine, because he is extremely narcissist, It's a very Adonis type of character, and I feel that this is the kind of person who wants to have a very visible role in things. He doesn't care if it has no impact. He just wants to be seen. And that's probably what motivates the role of France. The thing is that if the US is supporting the process that has been proposed by Vladimir Putin, if the Ukrainians are ready to play ball with the US and indirectly with the Russians to have these talks in Istanbul, probably Macron may change his mind in order to be on the right side of history, if you want. Because these guys, they don't have strategy. Their strategy is merely based on communication, on PR, period. There is no real sense of what they want to achieve. They don't even know what... I'm not sure they understand exactly what the Russians want. You know, so that's a source of concern. As you know, I'm former intelligence, strategic intelligence. So for me, it's essential that when you start to make decision at government level, that you understand your enemy or your adversary, depending on you. First point. And the second point, that you understand where you want to go. Where are you heading to? That's the key aspect. Then you may have different approaches or different strategies to address these objectives. But the objectives must be adjusted to your adversary. You cannot have an adversary and have an objective which is not tailored to the precise situation you are dealing with. And therefore, the strategy must then, it may change, of course, and you may have different approach to the problem, but it has to be directed towards this objective. And that's exactly the problem with people like Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron. These are not, they are not the brightest people in the shop, you know. They are not. They look so, they pretend so, but they are not. And the quality of a head of state is its ability to develop strategies and to act according to set strategies and clear objectives. They don't have any. Neither UK nor France have clear objectives in that. So it's just a matter of getting a high profile, and probably because as of now, the US got this profile, France may be willing to compete to some extent with Trump in order to have that. But the real problem in this conflict with Russia is that European countries don't have a strategy. They don't have objectives. They don't have a strategy. Trump had an objective, was to cease combat, which is already something. I'm not sure he got the right strategy to address that, and that's the reason why he had to change between Keith Kellogg and Steve Witkoff and all that to change position or approach on several occasions. And probably also that's also the reason why he tried to put pressure on Russia by advocating this idea of a 30-day ceasefire, probably because he had an objective, but he had no strategy. And therefore, he had to try several, and finally, he supported with the Europeans this idea of ceasefire. That made Russia to react. So, okay, why not? The Russian outsmarted the Western countries, definitely. And that's the reason why we may go towards a solution. Now, how long that will take? This is the big question, because the problem is, as I said before, that in the past, the Europeans and Ukrainians have managed to drag their feet in the negotiation in order to slow down the process. Of course, they had not the pressure of what's happening on the battlefield. That's what we are witnessing today, that the Russians are proceeding with their offensive. We talk about a large offensive with two reserve armies and all that. I don't know. I'm not in the secret decision making of Russia, so I have no idea. But this certainly contributes to exert some kind of pressure on the Ukrainians to achieve some results, and it's. Let's say we could expect that the Russians may attempt to have a large scale operation, let's say in the south of the country or so. Maybe, I don't know. But that, at the end of the day, such a possibility is, in fact, an incentive for Ukraine and the Europeans to achieve concrete results in the negotiation. So basically, we can say that the Russians are now playing on, like in an organ, you know, you have different keyboards and you play with a different keyboards. That's exactly what we are seeing. They are playing with the current operations. They are playing with the not open threat, but let's say the tacit threat of a potential operation in some part of Ukraine. And they have, as the third keyboard, is the negotiation. So, in fact, they managed to have the better set of conditions to address the conflict. So, we see that the Russians are strategists. The Western countries are tacticians. This is simply the illustration. And as I have said many times in your show and others, as Sun Tzu used to say, tactics without a strategy is simply noise before defeat. And that's exactly what we are witnessing when you look at Western countries, and in particular, the Europeans, because the Europeans have neither objectives nor strategy to address things. I mean, when you don't have an objective, there is no reason to have a strategy. So that's exactly what we are witnessing. But how long it will take, God knows.
I cannot imagine what could have been the case in Ukraine if Kamala Harris had won the presidential election in the United States. At least we are criticizing Donald Trump for what he's doing right now, but we know how much of the change came to the case of Ukraine. And Carol, do you think that Donald Trump is in the process of making, you talk about the tactics on the part of the West. How about the new administration? Do you think that they're in the process of making new strategies and seeing the bigger picture of what's going on?
Are you asking about the Europeans?
I'm talking about Donald Trump.
I think Trump is not a pacifist. He's just a man of its priorities. You know, the whole thing is, remember, he was elected on the basis of a program to make America great again. Now, the main problem for the U.S. is, in fact, to reshore industry and manufacturing industry on the U.S. continent. Now, to do that, obviously, they have to keep China at bay and probably even the Europeans. That's the reason for the tariffs and all that, in order to create a situation where you, let's say, favor, I would say, US domestic production, and you rely less on external production, but you rely mostly on domestic production. That's the idea. And based on this idea, he said, well, we spend a lot of money in wars that are, in fact, they're just costs. They generate costs, but no real revenue. And now we need revenues. So that's the reason why he doesn't want to engage into any conflict in Palestine, with Iran, and with Ukraine. And it's not because he doesn't like Ukraine. It's not because he finds that the Iranians are great people. It's not because he likes Palestinians. It's not that. But it is an opportunistic approach. He said, well, that's not my objective. That's why, by the way, because when you see the reluctance of certain individuals, not in the Trump administration, but in the Congress, the Lindsey Graham and the Tom Cotton and all that, who are definitely not supporting the idea, for instance, in having appeasement with Iran, for instance. So this is, these are, and we have seen the whole thing with Mike Waltz and all that, showing that there are strong opposition to that policy for now. And so that after Trump, that may resume all these issues. But for now, Trump has a clear objective, and this objective is an economic one, is a trade-related one, and that's what he wants. Whether or not he's using the right strategy to reach that objective, this is something we can also talk. But when it comes to Ukraine, the positive thing is that by putting priority on rebuilding U.S. industry, he doesn't want to spend more money on war, and therefore he wants to have those ceasefire, or let's say he wants the guns silent in these countries. And that's, in a sense, it's a positive aspect. But again, he's not because he despises the Ukrainians. It's simply because it's not the opportunity now to do so, period. I mean, it's not the opportunity to continue the fight and continue supporting Ukraine. It's a lot of money. Now, I think that's the important thing to understand. And probably the Russians have understood that as well, because they know that when it comes to sanction, when it comes to the rivalry between US and Russia, it may be softened a little bit in the next couple of years, but they know it will resume, because this sense of hegemony that you have in the US is there. It's cultural to some extent. It may take different forms. It may take more, let's say, military forms, more economic form, but we see that there's a continuity in reality when you see the sanctions. I mean, Trump used sanctions he has, in fact, militarized or weaponized sanctions, has weaponized economy. Sanctions, the secondary sanctions as well, and all that. So this is the problem of the United States. If for some reason, and probably some people who are more clever than me can probably study that more into the psychology, the collective psychology of the U.S., the history of the U.S. and all that. And there are probably some psychological constant in the behavior of the Americans, because we have seen, in fact, something very similar in the past, probably less in a less aggressive form. But in fact, this idea of the U.S. hegemony is there. So that will probably come back and take different forms in the future. So the Russians are aware of that, but now they are just seizing the moment and saying, okay, now we have a good condition to solve the problem in Ukraine. So that's the right moment to have a negotiation process, because the US is favoring that, and the next president might be different. And remember that even in the Republican Party, Trump has not only supporters, and not even mentioning the Democrats. So the future may have may show different things and different approach to the rivalry between this rivalry between US, China, and Russia. And maybe in the future you may add probably India as well. I don't know. In any case, the whole thing is not over. But right now, in the very short and mid-term, this is an opportunity for Russia. And I think they are ready to seize that opportunity. That's the interesting thing.
The case of the deal, mineral deal between the United States and Ukraine. When Donald Trump started talking about a new deal and expanding it with Russia as well, and in somehow through negotiations with Ukraine, they're going to have a new deal, rare earth mineral, and the Trump administration keeps saying about it, keeps talking about it. And do you find it as an element to bring some sort of stability to the region, or even having the Trump administration in office is going to be 4 years? What would happen in the aftermath of the Trump administration? Is the sort of participation of the United States or involvement of the United States in Ukraine, which we know it's economic, they're going to be politically, they're going to go to the military and all of that. It's the same sort of sequence that has happened before in Ukraine. Is that of concern for Russia, and how much of concern is that?
Well, again, I think the Russians understand the West better than the West understands Russia. That's the first point. The second point is that when we talk about the U.S. administration, with Biden, he's a politician, and you had the mere pure politician approach to the conflict. It's not economically viable. It's just politics, pure politics, influence politics, supremacist politics, what you can find different adjectives, but it's politics. Trump is a businessman. So everything comes back to business when it comes to him. He has lived, his life was business. He has made deal, and we are talking about deals, not agreements, not talks, not negotiations. It's deals, because he is a businessman. So that's how he sees the world. He sees people, and he has worked with people who were attracted by having deals, making money, and having this interest. And obviously, when he talks to Ukrainians, there's obviously this aspect. And probably whether it's conscious or not, but the Ukrainians are probably very, very sensitive to the money aspect of that. In that sense, probably Trump understood that. The Russians are much more cautious. They understand that we are essentially in a continuation that what happened during the Cold War. They understand that Trump will try to make his way through trade deals and things like this, but the Russians understand that it may work for a couple of years, but not necessarily for the rest. They remain competitors. And competitors, not just in economic terms, but also in political terms. And that will increase with the larger importance, the bigger importance of the BRICS. because now we have this shift as a consequence of the Western sanctions and the behavior of the West towards Russia and all that. This has created a climate that has, in fact, sponsored this idea of the BRICS and having kind of an alternative type of, let's say, I don't have the word right now.
Partnership or cooperation or maybe. Cooperation,
exactly, between the rest of the world. Meaning that, and with the China as a locomotive, the BRICS are getting more importance, and they will get more importance, especially because of the trade war between the US and China. And obviously, China will win this war, and therefore, they will increase the importance and increase the importance not just towards the West, but also the importance within the BRICS of this association with of the rest of the world. Therefore, the competition that exists between the US and the rest of the world will continue to increase. So that's certain. It will probably take some time because obviously the US now is not in a position to fight, quotation marks, to fight the rest of the world and especially China, but that will come back, meaning that Russia will be at one point will be back in kind of this competition with the US. And if you look at the BRICS, you have obviously China as an economic power. But when it comes to politics, when it comes to geostrategy, when it comes to military power, Russia comes in the forefront. So meaning that you have within the rest of the world, you have those two big elephants, China for the trade and Russia for the military and politics. And it's interesting, for instance, what we had this crisis between India and Pakistan. Very interesting to see that Pakistan asks the support of Russia, even if their traditional ally is China. Meaning that illustrates the weight that Russia gained in that. So meaning that in the future, we may have this, I would say, bipolar rest of the world that will, with Russia and China as the two locomotives in two different areas, but the two locomotives, and that will help to, these two will help the rest of the world to develop. Meaning that US will have to face those two, will face, in fact, three powers, the rest of the world as a whole, China in terms of trade, and Russia in the sense of a strategic, military strategic or geostrategic power. So we'll have that, and that will probably increase with the time. Meaning that the Russians understand that perfectly well, and they understand that anything that may happen with Trump today might become past issue within a couple of years, as soon as you have another a successor to Donald Trump in the White House. So I think the Russians are extremely cautious in that. They will accept to pay, and by the way, they agreed to have US companies coming back to Russia, but at certain conditions. You know, they made certain conditions for them to come back, meaning that they're absolutely not in a hurry to resume a normal trade relationship with the US, because they know that it may be short-lived. So this is the consequence of this conflict in Ukraine will be extremely long-lasting in the sense that it has destroyed the confidence that the rest of the world has towards the West, with the US and with the Europeans, certainly. I mean, the Europeans are probably the biggest losers in the whole conflict. I mean, economically, but also politically, we see that we mentioned Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, but we see these are the only two that we are mentioning. We're not even mentioning in the questions you asked before, you didn't even mention the European Union, which in fact should be the counterpart of the US or the China when it comes to trade and political power. But you didn't even mention that. And for a good reason, because Europe is just a non-actor de facto. And we have mentioned that several times when it comes to Palestine, when it comes to Iran, when it comes to Russia, the Europeans are just making some noise in the background, period. But they are not the main actors. That's the reason why Keir Starmer and Macron tries to get a higher profile in that. But the European Union as such has absolutely no impact whatsoever. We see that even Kaya Kallas is not even able to get out of her hate towards Russia. So she's not even able to address any other kind of problem. This is an intellectual issue there. They are focused on Russia and period. So beyond that, there's nobody. So, and when you talk about the individual countries, when it comes to foreign policy, for instance, we know Lamy, we know Jean-Noël Barrot in France, but these are practically absent on the international scene. We talk about Wang Yi, we talk about Suharto, we talk about Sergei Lavrov, we talk about these guys. These guys have a high profile on the international scene. When it comes to UK and all that, the Minister of Foreign Affairs is totally absent, period. So the whole thing shows that there is a total failure of the Europeans when it comes to foreign policy, international relations, with improving dialogue among within the international community, I mean, between Europe and the rest of the world. This is totally absent. On the contrary, they are kicked out of everything. The French have been kicked out of Africa, basically. And even now you have even the U.S., tries to, I mean, it's not kicking out, but ignores Israel. So we see that the Western world has enormously lost in this in those last 3 years. It has lost confidence. It has lost credibility. It has lost power. It has shown that it has absolutely no strategy whatsoever, whether in economic areas, in politics, in foreign policy, in security policy. Now they may have this initiative to rearm Europe, but we see that this come into a doctrinal and even political vacuum. There is no real, let's say, cooperation among European countries. The Germans want to have to restore their own industry. The French want to do the same. The UK want to, I mean, the UK is not part of the European Union, but still, I mean, we see that if it was not about Russia and fighting Russia, all these countries have no common interest. You know, it seems that Russia becomes the only common interest they have. And that shows, especially in all the challenges that we have in terms of climate, in terms of new technologies, in terms of industrial development, in terms of societal development, in terms of the whole issues related to artificial intelligence and all that, we see that the Europeans are not able to have a common view on that. And all these aspects are the future. I mean, they should require kind of a, probably not doctrinal, but at least a common understanding of the problems, a common position on that. But nobody is talking about this. The only common position they have is about Russia, period. And they don't know even why it's Russia. You know, it's just Russia because they don't like Russia. But it's not a common view in terms of improving relations with Russia. It's not something to improve things. The common view is that we should destroy Russia. That's basically the idea. I mean, to have some kind of collapse and to have a regime change. That's the objective. So it's destructive. It's not constructive. So we see that the Western world today is probably in its weakest configuration that it has been since the end of World War II. And that, of course, gives more room for the Trump administration for now, and more room for those powers such as Russia and China, who are gaining influence in the world, who are gaining respectability, who are gaining credibility, who are gaining influence in the rest of the world. So I think, by and large, I think the Europeans missed the train.
Colonel, you mentioned the situation in the Middle East with the case of Israel. It seems that Donald Trump is trying to somehow make some sort of modifications in the foreign policy of the United States in the Middle East. And they started talking with Hamas, of course, through Qataris and Egyptians. They're trying to negotiate on hostages. And it doesn't seem that Netanyahu is getting there, is not willing to go in that direction. How do you see Donald Trump and the way that he's trying to manage this issue with the case of Israel?
Well, I think the U.S. has understood that Israel is unreliable. You mentioned discussion with Hamas, but there have been also discussions with Ansarallah, the Houthis. And by the way, this agreement they have apparently reached exclude Israel. So in essence, it's about the Houthis not firing at the U.S. Navy. But when it comes to Israel, they don't really care. And that's an indication, because the purpose of the U.S. Navy to be in the Red Sea was precisely to protect Israel. So we see there a change, obviously. When it comes to Hamas, The U.S. has understood that if it tries to rely on Israel, they will never see the hostages back. And therefore, they have to engage discussion by themselves. Meaning that as it is for the Europeans, Israel loses credibility. The U.S. will continue to support Israel because they are not against Israel. But at the same time, they understand that it's not a reliable partner. And progressively, they will probably drop them. Interestingly enough, you may have, I mean, this week, apparently Trump will travel in the Middle East. He has no visit planned in Israel. Pete Hegseth, the Minister of Defense, had a visit planned in Israel, but he canceled this visit to Israel. You know, that shows that for the U.S., Israel is not a reliable partner. Trump will talk to the Saudis this week. And you know that there are two issues pending between the U.S. and Saudis. The first is the resumption of the agreement, I mean, the so-called the recognition of Israel by Saudi Arabia, basically the Abraham Accord or agreement. It's one point. And the second is the agreement on the nuclear So, I mean, the support of the U.S. for nuclear power to Saudis. And the Saudis, because they need energy, they realize that the oil will be, it's probably for a couple of years, but then they have to think further. And it's, I think, a good idea to think about nuclear power and all that. And for that, they wanted the support of the U.S. Now, the U.S., since it was a request from Saudi Arabia, they said they linked their support for nuclear power to the recognition of Israel. That was the policy of the U.S. Now, apparently, they have split the two. They have delinked the two aspects, meaning that the support to Saudi Arabia for nuclear power is delinked from the recognition of Israel. Meaning that, to some extent, U.S. is probably not trashing. It's probably not the right word to use, but they are thinking that Israel is not a reliable partner. And it's interesting also to listen what Trump said in a press conference regarding the agreement he had with the Houthis. He said two things that we have discussed. I mean, two words that we used probably in your show when we discussed the whole operations in Gaza. But he said the Houthis are brave, which obviously the Israeli are not in Gaza. And secondly, he said we can trust that they will fulfill their obligation. And that's exactly what the U.S. is noticing regarding Israel. Israel is not respecting what it signed. So you cannot trust Israel. And it's very interesting to see that in the same speech, Trump insisted on the bravery of the Houthis and the fact you can trust them for an agreement. And I interpreted that as a message towards Israel. If you look at all the context, you see that the Americans, yes, they will support Israel for many reasons, domestic reasons and probably historic reasons and all that. But at the same time, they realize that you cannot really trust them. Israel will work only for its own interest, will not even look at the regional interest. And if Israel has the ability to destroy everything around him, it will do that. And that's not the philosophy of the U.S. U.S. wants to be influential in the region, definitely. They definitely want to have this leading role, which they have, by the way, because when it comes to the solution in the Middle East, nobody talks about the Europe again. But when we talk about agreement and things like that, everybody looks at the U.S. Nobody looks at the Europe, at the European Union, or even at any European country. Meaning that they have this role, they want to keep this role to be influential in the region. But at the same time, they realize that so far, especially during the Cold War, they relied on Israel because Israel was some kind of advanced Western position in a Middle East that was strongly related to the Soviet Union. I mean, with differences depending on countries, probably not Jordan, for instance, but when it comes to Syria, when it comes to Egypt in certain phases and all that. I mean, obviously, they were either related or, yes, they had relation or strong relation with Soviet Union, or they were non-aligned, which for U.S. is not a good thing. So, and therefore now they are trying to reestablish relations with all these countries and to keep this kind of influence. We see that with Saudi Arabia. And probably this is this idea of Trump by having a deal with Iran. They see that Iran now has relation, normal relation with other Arab countries. I mean, with Arab countries, because Iran is not Arab country. But now we have that. And probably the US understand that if they want to keep their role in the region, they cannot just rely on Israel. This is the wrong ally in the region. And in addition to that, with everything that happened in the last year and a half or so, that you had all these violations of international humanitarian law, with all the crimes against humanity, crimes, I mean, you name it. I mean, Israel has probably now made it's probably hard to be more criminal than Israel, if you look at the way they wage warfare. And with the indictment of the International Criminal Court, with the pending decision of the International Court of Justice, I mean, Israel is the wrong ally. Why would you be allied of such a country that everybody despises? This is not the good thing. Now they realize that the Arab world deserve more attention, and this is probably the best way to have they deserve more attention from the US. So we may start to see a pattern here, and again there will be strong forces within the US to keep strong relationship with Israel. So I'm not saying that the traditional relationship with Israel will totally disappear, but they will probably lose in importance, and there will probably be more importance given to the Arab nations rather than just focusing on Israel. And I mean, at least under Trump, what happens after Trump, this is another story probably. But I think this is the way it's going. I mean, it's very hard today to say that you are an ally of Israel, a country that defies openly international humanitarian law. I mean, everything we have seen shows that if you have such a country as an ally, it's almost a condemnation on yourself. So I think Trump has realized this. Trump is not an ideologue. He's not an ideologist. He's not based on either. He's probably more human in a certain sense, that he feels things more than he thinks things. And that probably the way he understands things. And that probably explains what happened last week regarding the relationships between Israel and the US. What strikes me is the inability of Israel to identify this. Of course, Israel in the past couple of years, especially since the 7th of October 2023, Israel can afford to play like a spoiled kid, because everything they will do, I mean, you see Annalena Baerbock, the Germanys, I mean, they don't care about massacres of Palestinians. Well, these are countries that have a huge past of racism. Talk about France towards the Arabs and all that. I mean, this is there's also a weight of history over these countries. That's one thing. But it's interesting to see that everything they claim to support when it comes to Ukraine, they forget when it comes to Israel. I mean, those values, we don't even know what kind of values it is, but the values they claim about Israel, I mean, that justify the support of Ukraine against Russia, suddenly when it comes to Israel, suddenly all these values have disappeared. They vanish. literally. And this is a kind of contradiction that the governments can play with, but the populations don't play ball with them anymore. And that's probably what explains, I mean, not exclusively the relation with Israel and the Middle East, obviously, because that applies to everything in the behavior of these countries. There's total, let's say, inconsistent approach to problems. And this is inconsistency is exactly what drives the population to change the path of politics. We see that in Germany with the AfD. We have seen that in the recent partial elections in the UK. The support of Keir Starmer is vanishing. This is very strong in France as well. And in other countries, people realize that the so-called elites that we have in Europe are simply inconsistent, incoherent, unable to elaborate consistent strategies, to have consistent objectives, to have objectives consistent with so-called values and all that. And I think that's exactly what the population, that's exactly what drives the split between the populations and their governments. And so I'm a little bit pessimistic about what may happen in Europe in the future. I mean, I'm not saying that it will be civil war. This is probably not that. But that may lead to some instability, and probably more instability than we have now, and changes in policy as we may see in Germany also. And even within the European Union, because now you have countries, I mean, when you see that countries such as the Baltic states have literally weaponized history in order to prevent a leader such as Vucic from Serbia and Fico from Slovakia to fly towards towards Moscow, then you understand that we are beyond common sense. We are in something which is it's primary school type of politics and foreign policy, which is the level of what we had as kids, period. And that's not something that can help to restore the trust and the credibility of the West. And that's what we have seen before. I mean, we have mentioned that before today. That's exactly what the West is now missing when it comes to the rest of the world. They don't trust the West anymore. They see how they behave up to the point to destroy themselves. It's almost a kind of a suicidal type of foreign policy when it comes to the sanctions against Russia and all that. I mean, this is beyond common sense. And remember that what we are witnessing today has never been so, even during the Cold War. Even during the Cold War. You know, the Russians / Soviets at the time have delivered gas, natural gas, to Europe since the late 60s without interruption. Even after Prague, even after Afghanistan, even the Russians never stopped to deliver gas. Even when they had sanctions, even when they never stopped to have that. And we tried to avoid to apply sanctions on the Soviet Union. There was some restriction, embargo on certain technologies and all that, but that was all the technologies that were related to national security and all that, so that was a kind of standard procedure in the Cold War. But there have never been the animosity that we are, and acrimony that we see today, have never been so during the Cold War. We talked to the Soviets at the time, even if we didn't agree with them. We are fighting a system, the communist system. We didn't want to be communist. Obviously not. for good or bad reason, but that was the stance. But that didn't prevent us to talk to them. And we had dialogue with the Russians, with the Soviets, with all the Warsaw Pact countries. We never had this kind of obsessive approach to the Russians and others as we have today. So this is really a change, and I've been literally a Cold Warrior because I was in the intelligence world during the Cold War. So we experienced the war in one-to-one scale. So, but we never had such a spirit of destructive type of spirit that we have today, that we see today in Europe. So I think we went backwards in Europe, definitely. We are not improving. We regressed. It's a regression, an intellectual, even philosophical, and even, I would say, in terms of human relation, it is a regression that we have. Remember that, for instance, in France, if you have a name that sounds like Russian, you don't need to be Russian. Even if your name sounds Russian, a bank can refuse to you to open a bank account. So we are beyond rational. We are beyond reason. It has become totally insane. And this has never been so in the Cold War. So I think we are definitely witnessing a regression of humanity in Europe.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Carol, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
That was my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.